So we are coming right up on that scheduled start time of 1 p.m. Eastern. And in the interest of time, I think I'm going to go ahead and officially welcome everybody to today's Clue-In Seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division based in Washington, D.C., where I'll help to moderate today's Clue-In Seminar. Again, our session will look at practical models to support remediation strategy decision-making. This is part two of a five-part seminar series. Part one was hosted last week, has already been recorded, and is available for free replay on the Clue-In website. So if you haven't done check that one out, you want to be sure to go back to the Clue-In archives and replay part one to keep up with the series. I'm going to go through a couple of housekeeping and reminder items before we turn things over to our presenters for the technical broadcast today. As I mentioned earlier, we're trying out a brand new tool. We used it last week for the first time and things went well, so we're going to carry on with our test run of using Adobe Connect. Using this new tool, our participants will be able to not only listen but watch the entire presentation be delivered live through an online meeting environment. Our individual presenters will be manually moving through the materials at their own respective locations. So you, as participants, simply need to sit back and watch the presentation as it's delivered live. There's no more turning the page or paying attention to the slide number as you might be used to for Clue-In seminars. Some of you may not be in the Adobe Connect room and be having some technical issues, and we apologize for that. If you're only following along with print materials or on the telephone lines, Please bear with us as we're trying to perfect this delivery. Do apologize for that, but not everything will be available purely through hard copy or telephone lines. Some portions of today's talk will actually be delivered as a live demonstration of software. So there'll be some things that you'll miss if you're only participating on the phone. And we would encourage you to work with us to help troubleshoot any issues you might have with Adobe Connect so that you can participate in the rest of the series correctly. As I mentioned earlier, audio by default for today's session, using this new tool, will be delivered online through your computer speakers. Adobe Connect does have mobile applications, so some of you may be listening on iPads, Android tablets, or other mobile devices. But either way, you'll be able to listen to us through the electronic device. If you're having any problems with the online audio stream, first make sure that that computer icon in the Adobe Connect room is clicked and shaded bright green. You can click the little downward-pointing triangle that appears just to the right of it if you want to adjust your audio. You can also check your speakers, manually adjust your volume on your mobile device, or even try headphones if you find that the volume is too faint. There's a limited number of phone lines we've made available for today's broadcast. Those of you on the phones have been muted out, and we would ask that you remain muted until we get to that break for Q&A with our presenters. I'll remind you how you can unmute it at that time. Otherwise, simply, again, remain mute. Do not put the call on hold. As I mentioned, we will take a break for Q&A with our presenters as time permits. We do have some spaces allocated, and we'll use them as best we can with all the material that we have to cover today. If you're listening to the audio online, in order to ask a question, you'll need to use one of the pods or windows that you see in front of you today. Again, I've got the slides up in the main portion of the screen, but just to the right of them, you'll see a Q&A pod. You can actually type up a question or comment in the lower bottom portion and hit enter, and that'll privately submit the question to me. When we get to that break for Q&A with our presenters, I'll read your question out loud. Those questions will remain queued up, so I would encourage you to type up your questions or comments as soon as they occur to you. You don't need to wait till the break. And in fact, I'd encourage you to do that because whatever we can't get through live, I'll be able to share that with our presenters and have them come up with answers and get them to you after the live delivery. In fact, there were a number of questions that we didn't get through in last week's live broadcast. We have gotten written responses from our presenters, and we'll be posting those questions and answers on the archive page for last week's seminar. So in just about an hour or so, you'll be able to find them for part one, and we'll do the same thing for part two. You can also use that Q&A pod to type up any technical issues or glitches you might be experiencing with Adobe Connect. Today's session is being recorded. Again, we should get the recording up in about 1 to 2 days, and you'll automatically get an email. Even if you're on the wait list, you will get an email once that archived version is available so that you'll be able to replay it in time for the next delivery in the series. We'd also welcome you to forward that on to any colleagues that you think will find it useful. If you're interested, you can take a look at our almost 500 archived Clue-In seminars at the URL shown on slide two, that housekeeping slide. So again, just one or two reminders. We're using a brand new tool. You'll notice that the window's broken up. You should be able to see most of the content towards the left side of the screen where I've got the slide deck up now. As each of our presenters start showing their content from their respective geographic locations, you'll be able to watch in real time and simply sit back and observe. You may notice, though, this window does shift. So when we get to certain exercises, the pods will rearrange themselves so you can actually download files, pull up important URLs right through the Adobe Connect window. If you're having any problems viewing content, this is one thing that might be particularly helpful for today. There's a button that will permit you to actually make things go full screen. So if you're looking at the slides, you'll see in an upper right corner a button that says full screen. If you click that, that'll actually blow up the shared content and make it larger. If you want to turn that off, so you can go ahead and ask a question, click the full screen button again. That'll minimize things down. You can use the other parts of the windows. That only affects what you're looking at. It doesn't impact anybody else's view. So in particular, when we're doing our software broadcast or software demos, you may want to use that full screen option so you can see everything. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for everybody today. So I'm going to go ahead on slide number 4 and turn things over to our presenters. And I believe Brian Looney is going to take things over.
Hi, this is Brian Looney. What I'd like to do is actually get us into this fairly efficiently today because we have a lot of material to go through. But I think what I'd like to do as a team, we want to acknowledge and express our sincere gratitude to all those who have sponsored the development and delivery of this workshop, and in fact sponsored the development of some of the tools. And that's, I'm going to go in reverse order this week, Department of Energy, ESTCP and CERTIP, DOD, the Department of Defense, and then several organizations within EPA, Circle Education Center, the ORD, Superfund and Technology Liaison Program, Underground Storage Tank Program, have all been tremendously helpful in this course development. And what we'd like to do is also recognize a couple of individuals. So our specific sponsor at EPA, Kara Lynch, and then her colleague, Queenie Mungin Davis, have been very helpful. And then as you heard, Jean Ballant, who has done a yeoman's job getting this new tool up. And I guess on that front, I'm going to turn it over to Kira, our EPA sponsor.
Thanks, Brian. So this is Kira Lynch. I'm the Superfund Tech Liaison from Region 10. And I'm just going to kick off the seminar today. We did want to make a note that, you know, really what we're trying to present today is a tool or tools with both RemFuel and RemCore that can help people think together to be able to look at making smarter objectives that are linked to what they think is going to be happening with these large, complex groundwater plumes. So we wanted to point out that nothing that we're going to talk about today is setting policy outside of the National Contingency Plan. And we are definitely promoting the idea that we must develop our remedial action objectives appropriate to the scope of the proposed action. And that's going to be different on every site. But what we're hoping is that today we will provide you with some useful information and about an additional tool that can really help you with your planning on these complex groundwater sites. Thanks, Brian.
Sure. So what we're really talking about is some of these tools that are available to help us make strategic, thoughtful decisions. And as Kira said, we're talking about calculations and models and tools that blend into, for example, the CERCLA criteria, the RCRA criteria, all of the requirements that are out there. But within those, how can we, in essence, make metrics that are strategic and thoughtful and responsive to the actions and all of those kinds of things? And this is where models come in. There's a whole array of models that range, as we said last week, from hand calculations all the way up to very sophisticated numerical models, ModFlow, TUF, RT3D, things like that. And what we found through the years is that kind of a sweet spot in modeling for a lot of sites are tools that are in this intermediate kind of analytical range, and particularly if you use these tools in combination with each other. And today we're going to talk mostly about RemCore and RemFuel, but they're really just examples. We're not about trying to advocate one brand of model or another. But one of the reasons we like these in these models is they're set up to where the input, and you'll see this today, is structured so that it encourages you to explore strategic decisions associated with site management, cleanup of sources, cleanup of plumes. And by being structured in that way, it makes it fast to do some of these models and calculations. The other part of it is then you can use this for screening, and if a site is somewhat more complex, you can always go in and after that initial screening phase do more sophisticated modeling, but do it more efficiently and more effectively because it's being guided by what you learned before. The two main people that are working with us today are Ron Falta from Clemson, who is a modeler who has develop some of these practical tools, but also is familiar with modeling that goes all the way from the simplest to the most complex, and was one of the authors of, was the author of T2VOC, one of the most sophisticated models that are available to us. And another main presenter today is Chuck Newell from GSI, and his focus is really communicating the state of practice and the state of knowledge, and he's worked with EPA and DOD on those fronts, and his company has developed a lot of the simple calculator-style tools and some of these analytical models. So what we have is a diverse kind of group team that's putting this together, and I think you'll see as we go through the presentation, there's a diversity of opinions and ideas even among us on the team. So I guess one of the most important take-home messages, in most of these cases, there's not a right answer, and the solution is kind of embracing the different diversity and ideas that are out there, and then together coming up with a strategy or strategic approach. There are other folks who are key to this workshop. Karen Vangelis was our project manager when we first put the bones of this together, and we developed this originally. It was delivered at several EPA regions, and it was in the room. And so it's been a real interesting effort to migrate this to the web and to this format, because when you're doing software, it was really nice to be able to walk around and peer over people's shoulders and make specific suggestions. So bear with us, because we're in the process of trying to do this migration, and so what we're going to do is we're going to do walkthroughs, and we're going to encourage you to like get on the computer and things like that. If there's any frustration, bear with us and then communicate with us, and we'll get all of it worked out. Myself, I was a technical coordinator for the development of this, and Shala Farhat, who's working with Chuck down in Houston, and she's put several of these practical tools together and was at the heart of organizing this into a class. So that's really what we have. It's really interesting to participate in this because we have people in different states and localities. We have people in Texas, people two different locations in South Carolina, Washington State, and Arlington, Virginia, that are all kind of delivering this. So it's a very new experience for all of us, and we hope that you enjoy that. First thing we're going to do, Chuck's going to come on in just a second, but he's getting the homework assignment up so we can have a discussion on that. And one of the things that that Jean has allowed us to do is if you had questions on the homework, if you type them in, she's given us access so we can see those. And while we might not call them out individually, what we'll do is we'll try to summarize answers to those as we go along.
Thanks, Brian. And this is Chuck Newell here. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the on-the-fly remediation homework problem number one. And this was something that you could download and take a look at and try to fill out the worksheet. And then I don't know if we told you this, but the answers were actually on the last page of the homework analysis. So this is just, you know, maybe a cruel joke to some of you who spent all this time on it, but it's really the last page is what we're showing here in terms of the problem. The problem was there was this plume, and you needed some fairly quick method to evaluate over the long term, the long run, what would happen if you did a source remediation. And for the purpose of this, we said you could do a source remediation using some technology, remove 90% of the mass, And then according to the mathematics of this advection dispersion equation, then all the down gradient concentrations also get reduced by this order of magnitude or by this this 90% factor. And if you do this and just adjust the contour lines, each one then sort of moves in one, then this plume, instead of going all the way down to the canal down there, is now about half as long as it used to be. And this is the what we call the plume response from this, this 90% removal. I think the key point is both RemFuel and RemClor do this kind of work. If you actually put in a certain percent mass that's removed from the source, it's going to show you that plume response. But it actually has a lot more sophistication built in than this very simple method. It will tell you how long it takes for that plume to recede and get to its new equilibrium level. If you remove some mass from the source, it may have different effects depending on what that gamma function you put in there. So this simple exercise, again, was something if you did coach the 6 soccer games in one day and you needed a very quick answer. But the RemFuel or RemClor are this next step up where you can look at this information and see it. Brian, Ron, anything you wanted to add to homework exercise number one?
Yeah, I think the key point you made there is that this is a steady state. So this is what happens over a long period of time. So if you were to run RemClor, RemFuel, you might get some strange behaviors like portions of the plume that float away, but this is the new plume that would form after an extended time frame. The other thing, and we'll get into this more later on, is you see that you get a different response as a function of the amount of the different concentrations. So that the very distal portion of the plume recedes halfway back, but the portion that was halfway back before recedes very near the source. So what we see, and we'll do some more math on this later on, is that the structure of the plume, the high concentration contours respond much more strongly to source remediation than the most distant contours. And so that may be something that we'll eventually want to crank into our thinking for, you know, what kind of metrics can we set that are responsive to our actions.
Well, great. Thanks, Brian. So that's the homework problem. I think perhaps we'll move ahead. Let's go back to the PowerPoint show. We also talked about responses to Module 1 questions. So I think we answered about half of them during our question-answer break. The other half, we wrote up some answers. And, Gene, what's the status of those? Are they going to be put on the system here pretty soon?
Yep. They're going to be up. Actually, I'll have them available to download as part of the file download later today within this room, but we'll also have it posted on the archive page for Seminar 1 in probably just an hour or so.
Great. Okay, so we got some great questions. Thanks for all the feedback on that. And then I think it's about 4 or 5 pages, and you can take a look there. So with that, let's go into an explanation of how the plume part works in RemClor. Remember, we've got these two models. There's this analytical model that has this power law, this gamma piece in there, this dial you can turn. And then there's all these stream tubes leaving this source, thousands of them. And then with the stream tubes, you can go in there and look at this whole plume response occurs. So the next couple of slides, I'm going to show you how this works, how the plume piece works. We talked about the source piece in Module 1. But also we're going to sprinkle this with some stuff from the technical literature. I literally use the word stuff, just some key graphics, some ideas on how some of these plumes worked with some of the most recent research, and give you a feel for how that looks. So with that, let's go with a key concept, number 2, plumes. The key driver here is this discharge, and I'm calling this mass discharge. Some people call this mass flux, but it's the grams per day leaving that source zone. In this case, we've got this vadozone source that we envision as a box, a little bit of it's in the saturated zone, and a certain number of grams per day are coming out and leaving the source zone. Then once you're in the plume itself, then what you've got is this key process of advection. That's our friend Darcy's law. We've got dispersion. That's some people call this the mixing that occurs in the subsurface. Other people refer to it as more of a fudge factor to account for heterogeneity that may be down there. Sorption. If you look at RemClor, RemFuel, it's going to ask, what is the retardation factor for the specific chemicals you're going to want to try to model? And then finally, degradation. And we do this with these first order decay coefficients, or what I call lambdas. So that's the overview. Let's throw up the math again, and this is this partial differential equation, the advection dispersion equation. It really should be called the advection dispersion retardation reaction equation. If you look at this, you can see the different terms in there. There's terms for this dispersivity or this spreading or this this heterogeneity factor. There's our friend Darcy's law on the bottom. This happens to be a seepage velocity. We're dividing it by the effective porosity. And on the very far right-hand side of the yellow piece, we've got this reaction term that's in there. So both RemFuel and RemClor handle all these terms, and they tell you the plume response using this framework, this equation that's shown right up in here. Now, in terms of biodegradation, that's a key process from both sides of the house, both the chlorinated solvents and the fuels. And our conceptual models are how these things work, that we've got these naturally occurring bugs, microorganisms, and as we learn more about the subsurface, we become more and more impressed and amazed by their robustness and how you're ubiquitous and what they can do down there. But to get these things to work, basically need electron donor and electron acceptor. And depending on which house you're in, the fuels or chlorinated solvents, they can be different things. So if you're talking about RemFuel and you want to model benzene, for example, then benzene serves as the electron donor, and then these other constituents are down there, oxygen, nitrate, sulfate, which are coming in from clean groundwater from a gradient, are going to serve as the electron acceptor. It also can utilize solid iron, ferric iron, from the soil matrix. But in that case, the electron acceptors are what drives this reaction for the fuels and the BTEX compounds. Chlorinated solvents, a totally different world here. The chlorinated solvents, the more chlorinated ones are the electron acceptors, and the hydrogen or acetate then serves as the electron donor. Instead of breathing the oxygen, they really want this hydrogen in there, and so that's a sort of a different framework. Now, I have to say that while something like Darcy's law is fairly straightforward, if you understand the hydrogeology, the biodegradation reactions can get pretty complex. There are all these sort of different sort of rules. There are these different functions. You got to know the different conditions, different reactions. And so there is a lot of complexity in here. And so if you really wanted to apply some of these different complexity rules, there's ways to do it in RemFuel, RemClor. Just take a little knowledge of what these different pathways are in these decay chains. And that's what we'll talk about in the next slide here. So we're going to first put on our chlorinated solvent hat, and we've got this decay chain starting out with perchloroethylene. I'm just showing an example for the chlorinated ethenes. And then if it's anaerobic, we say here, it can, under this halorespiration process or reductive dechlorination, it can be dechlorinated to TCE. And these bacteria, these dechlorinators, are sort of pulling off these chlorines one by one. And then from PCE to TCE, then there's this very important marker, a biological marker. If you see cis-12-DCE down there, that's likely this biological byproduct of TCE. Sometimes that can stall down in there for various reasons, not the right bacteria, maybe just not anaerobic enough. But if you pull off another chlorinated solvent from the chlorine atom from the DCE, you get vinyl chloride, and then all the way down there to ethane. So a lot of complexity in this thing, and then we've got some arrows off to the right. Brian, you're one of the world's experts on co-metabolism. You want to fill us in on that?
Yeah, so basically what Chuck has put down the heart of this slide is the traditional thinking for anaerobic degradation, which is relatively rapid for the chlorinated solvents, at least until you get down to the ones that have fewer chlorines on them. But one of the things that Chuck and I have always had spirited discussions about is almost every site I work at is aerobic, and so the anaerobic reactions are relatively slow. But the aerobic reactions are occurring, and what you see is that PCE, the tetrachloroethylene, the most chlorinated ethene in this case, doesn't have much that goes on aerobically, but virtually every other of these compounds has some aerobic degradation pathway that's available to it. Now, one of the reasons why it hasn't been discussed as much in the literature and in modeling is because the rates, for example, for TCE are relatively slow compared to reductive processes, anaerobic processes, you know, at anaerobic sites. But they're not zero. And so what happens in aerobic co-metabolism of TCE and other similar compounds is enzymes that are intended to oxidize other compounds, things like toluene or methane or propane or things like that. So propane monooxygenase or toluene dioxygenase, those kinds of enzymes, are pretty loose in their specificity, and so they will accidentally oxidize TCE. And there's been a lot of research done on that, and so we're at the point now where rates can be estimated. And I think the key factor for models, both simple and sophisticated models, is that if you can develop one of these first order decay rates, and then you know what the daughters or offspring of the reaction are, then they can be put into the model. And Ron will show us how to do that in a while. In the case of aerobic co-metabolism, the offspring or the daughter is typically a chloroacetic acid, which then further breaks down and ends up as carbon dioxide fairly quickly. So what you see is that in that case, you would put TCE, and then you, in essence, wouldn't have a toxic daughter product. So that's really what we can do. And the key is that as long as you know and can document a legitimate degradation process and can estimate a rate using a scientifically, technically valid approach, that process can be put in the model.
And then it's really thinking about, I think about this model as you're staring at that input screen, you got to put these numbers in there, or these values. And in this case, you've got this decay chain. I'll go to the next slide here, and you can see it rolled out from right to left. Here's PCE going to TCE. And if you're going down this chain all the way, then you would enter in to RemChlor, in this example, this lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, and lambda 4. And you could manipulate these to match your site conditions that's out there in these particular zones where you have monitoring wells. You also enter in something called a yield factor. And what this does is it tells you how much of the TCE, for example, is going to the DCE. Now, if you have a co-metabolism type reaction, you can adjust those yield numbers so that, the TCE could go all the way by co-metabolism to something else and doesn't show up as DCE. So a lot of flexibility, but in terms of how the biodegradation works in the plume, you got to think about these lambdas, and there are a lot of men here. We'll get into that in just a bit. But in this case, you need four lambdas to tell the different transformations between these five different compounds. Now, what this will do, and then just look at the rate equations on the bottom briefly, we just have this minus lambda. That means the PCE is going away. But if you start adding these rate equations, and they're being added to the advection dispersion equation, in this case, for TCE, any PCE that gets destroyed turns into TCE. So that first term down in here that I'm pointing to with the cursor, if I can get it, is this is that's the formation of TCE from the destruction of PCE. And then off here to the right, this lambda 2 term, that's this degradation that then goes on as it sort of marches down and its ride down the chain. Now, looking at a graph, this is what you might see, distance from the source versus on the x-axis versus concentration on the y-axis. Here is a parent compound. In this case, we don't have any PCE, no PERC, just the trichloroethylene going down. And then you have some of this DCE being formed out there in the plume. It starts going down, and the vinyl chloride then shows up. Now, so that's the basic premise to how it works. But a lot of these sites are more complicated than that. It's not just as if I've got one geochemical type zone here. It's anaerobic over the entire plume. A lot of these plumes will have different geochemical factors in different places. And so what RemChlor does is it lets you divide this up into three different zones. And so here's the reaction, an example of a reaction that you could do, where zone one, let's say it's deeply anaerobic. Now, for these chlorinated solvents, what does that mean? Pretty high decay rates. And so you might put in half-lives of 2 or 3 years for these different compounds in this zone one. And this whole thing is generating TCE, then cis, and ethene is being produced in there. But then let's say in zone two, you're really concerned about the vinyl chloride and cis DCE. Then you turn that, you'd say that's aerobic, and then any degradation of PCE and TCE would get turned off, but then you'd have different rates for these aerobic reactions. So that it's a whole set of another lambdas you'd put in there for zone two. Zone three, maybe it's lower background rates for anything that's gone through this gauntlet of the anaerobic zone and the aerobic zone, but then you can model that with, say, lower rates that are in there. So just an example on the chlorinated side, how you do this, you can break up this plume into three zones, and that's a total of 12 different lambdas you'd put in there to express what's going on in terms of the three zones. It gets more complicated than that coming up. But first, let's just take another, say, a detour to the you fuel guys out there. RemFuel will do the same thing here for MTBE degradation. So here we've got a chart. We've got a slow hydrolysis reaction, not that important, going off to the right. And we say that MTBE will degrade under aerobic conditions. Sometimes it needs acclimation. or more slowly under anaerobic conditions. And then that will produce this terpbutyl alcohol, this TBA. And that will degrade under aerobic or under anaerobic conditions, except if it's deeply anaerobic. If there's no other electron acceptors there, if there's no sulfate, if there's no nothing like that, then TBA can hold up and stall out in there. Now, we'll sort of lay out this decay chain this way, and this is, I have to say, a pretty simplified decay chain. But in terms of the way the model thinks about this, if you are modeling MTBE with REM fuel, then you have this lambda 1 you put in there. That's how quickly the MTBE is going away. Then this TBA is being formed, and lambda 2 is how quickly it goes away. Now, it goes away through a lot of different steps. But to really simplify this in terms of lumpers and splitters, this is a lumper heaven here, then that eventually ends up as CO2. Same types of reactions down below. This rate is equal to lambda 1 times the concentration of the MTBE. The rate of the TBA is dependent on two factors, how quickly that MTBA is being converted, destroyed down the steps so that it's making this terpbutyl alcohol, and number 2 is how quickly the TBA itself is going away. Let's go to this zone map here, and here again is just another example. You can really have it different shapes and different forms. But let's say zone 1, deeply anaerobic, it's very methanogenic, the MTB is degrading, but the TBA, it's hard to get that stuff to go if it's very deeply methanogenic, no other help from sulfate or anything else. But then you go to zone 2 where there may be more oxygen in there, and in this case both of these guys are going away. So you can look at things like at some sites it appears TBA is accumulating a bit, and you can simulate sites where you see some of that. Let's go to some data, and I've got some data from a 2012 report done by my colleague Tom McHugh here at GSI. This is done for the American Petroleum Institute. This is February 2012. So I'm going to set this up and then go to a site that, or another slide, the next slide that talks about MTB and TBA. So a lot of stuff going on here, but I call this the $100 million graph because this is about 2 million data points. This is a synthesis of 2 million data points from the California GeoTracker database. For over 10 years. And what Tom did is he went to one site that had benzene in California that was in the GeoTracker database, and he looked at a six-month period, and he took the maximum concentration any place in that site. Then he repeated it for all the other sites, 6,500 in 2001, and got all this information for that. So he had 6,500 numbers of these maximum site concentrations. Then he took the middle value of those 6,500, and that's those blue diamonds. Now, the black line is the number of sites that's monitored. It sort of goes up and then starts tailing down as sites are getting closed. But the message here in this particular statistical treatment is that the benzene concentrations have gone down quite a bit, and you almost see a little tailing off at the tail end down there. And so this may be related to part of the number of sites that are monitored, but you're looking at this long-term trend, and we're seeing this stuff go down. I will mention, and we've got actually a slide on this, that this is a combination, I think, of both monitored natural attenuation and active remediation. And you see this sort of decline over time and the benzene. Let's see what happens on the MTBE side. So on this one, on the left, same sort of axes. We've got the concentration of MTBE on the left. We've got this time. And it, if anything, has got even a more dramatic decline, and then this sort of tail comes off. This is reminiscent of some of the discussions we had about gammas, maybe gammas greater than 2. But of course, this represents a lot of different sites, so it's not site-specific. But it was interesting, in their paper, they say the TBA has a different trend. It seems to be sort of hovering around lower concentrations, but this is this, I think, phenomenon that in TBA under some environments just doesn't degrade very fast. So we thought we'd just throw this data just to show you some of the stuff that's out there in terms of the fuel world and what I think is a pretty interesting, pretty expensive data set in terms of a lot of the work we've done over time. I think the good news, these concentrations are going down, and that's in terms of the benefits of remediation, in terms of M&A, some good message out there with the benzene and with the MTBE.
So, Chuck, this is Brian. So, basically, a take-home message is that, you know, when you look at a large universe of sites out there, there is a tendency for sites over the last decade or so to have lower concentrations now than they did, and that's a testament to cleanup activities that are going on, natural attenuation, a variety of other things. But it's also a testament, and this is where, on a site-specific basis, you know, that anaerobic area around a hydrocarbon spill, where rates may be slow for BTECs and some other things, can be accounted for in models, and then maybe an aerobic surrounding area, and then rates there can be accounted for, so that on kind of a large number site basis and a site-specific basis, there's some messages, I think, that can come from this.
Yeah, it's an interesting database. There's a lot to that. Of course, there's another factor on the MTB side is the phase-out of MTB in gasoline.
Sure.
That's another factor seeing for this drop. But I think we're going to show a slide that I think almost all of these sites here had some sort of remediation with them. So that's coming up in a couple slides later down the road. But let's go back to sort of REM fuel, REM chlor, and now I'm going to put on my Captain Kirk Star Trek hat and talk about space-time. So on this slide right in here, we talked about that you can divide up REM fuel or REM chlor into these three different zones, but you can also divide it up to three different time periods. And so we're talking about the plume. We're talking about putting up to four lambdas in each one of these nine boxes. And this just says that, let's go for the bottom row here. Time is on the y-axis, so as you're getting higher, you're getting farther ahead in time. You're starting out in 1975. From 1975 to 2005, the site wasn't acted on. Nobody did anything out there. It was all natural attenuation. And this is distance on the source on the x-axis. So you can divide it up into three zones, so left, right, and left, middle, and right, and put in different lambdas if it's strong natural attenuation near the source and weaker as you get out there. Then in this 20-year period, 2005-2025, let's say you go up there and you're adding lactate into this first 400 meters down the source zone to get this anaerobic degradation up. Then you're doing air sparging in this middle zone and the natural attenuation down there. Then you could put in different lambdas for those guys, and those would be higher numbers because they would be higher degradation rates. And then 2025, if there's some residual contaminant left over, then you might say, I'm going to go back to slower rates, and you can then visualize what that plume response would be. Ron, Brian, anything you want to add to this? I think this is a key concept, key power of REM chlor.
It is. This is Ron. This diagram is really the key to how the plume model works in both REM chlor and REM fuel. So each one of these boxes is representing a geochemical zone that's active over some distance over some period of time. And when you move into a different box, you can change the conditions. So if the contaminants move down gradient, they move into a different zone, now we can have a different set of conditions, and that's reflected in these decay rates. Or if we move forward in time and into a new time period where we're actively doing something to it, like adding lactate, again, we can change the rates. But visualizing this box as a way of looking at both distance and time is the key to using these plume models. And as you'll see when we walk through the program, the data go into a matrix that looks just like this shape here, a 3x3 sort of tic-tac-toe board.
And this, Brian, I think the beauty of this is that you can be as creative or as flexible with these as possible, so you can think of them as near source. These are all in the plume now. They're not in the source, they're in the plume. You can think of them as near source, mid-plume, distal plume. You can make the middle box really small, and it can represent, for example, a permeable reactive barrier. And there's all kinds of options. So one of the beauties of this is that it allows you to be as kind of innovative or creative in setting up a very simple model as possible.
And, of course, the big advantage, finally, is that if you go home and your kids ask you or wife asks you, what'd you do today? You could say, well, I spent all of my time doing data mining for lambdas to put in the different space time zones in REM chlor. Sounds very impressive, and I do it all the time. So let's talk about wrapping up sort of this plume, the space time story. This is both with REM chlor and REM fuel. How does this stuff work? Both models allow the plume to develop for a number of years before you go in there. That's a key advantage over BioScreen and BioChlor, and then you can go in and do remediation 30 years after that source was released. Number two, you can simulate these three different natural reaction zones, and you can do this at different periods of time. Next is you can remediate all or part of the plume just by increasing these lambdas, and you can do it for a certain period of time, maybe just 1 year, 5 years, and you pick all that. And at the end of the day, these tools are going to give you this calculation or this estimate of plume response that combines all these different factors, natural attenuation processes, plume remediation, natural flushing out of the source or the source decay, and then source remediation. You can see all that. And just with eventually, we just say that, remember, it takes some travel time for those benefits to get down in there, and you can look at that and understand when you're going to see the benefits of that source remediation. So that's the wrap-up for the plume. Let's go back to the agenda. Now we're going to start talking about some of the key questions, and we're going to dive in here with the first one. Remember, a lot of these questions are interrelated, and how to use these tools to get you information to help you think about these things. So let's do the first one, and that's, will source remediation meet site goals? And here I just got some examples of two documents that I think talk about goals and objectives. The first one is the U.S. EPA Dean Apple Challenge document. Is there a case for source depletion? This was an expert panel that both Ron and I served on. This is a bit dated, 2003, but they talk about different benefits in one of the tables in there, the benefits of source remediation and how to evaluate a site. Some of the benefits might be reducing potential for Dean Apple migration, reducing long-term management requirements, enhancing natural attenuation, reducing the loading to a receptor, attaining MCLs, and then finally stewardship. That's an interesting one that Suresh Rao was on the group put in there. Is that a factor for doing this remediation? Then we have the ITRC LNAPL guidance, an excellent document that talks about LNAPL sites and evaluating LNAPL remedial technologies for achieving project goals. And here's some of their objectives slash goals that they talk about. Maybe reducing LNAPL to a certain residual saturation range to think to sort of reduce the chance for mobility. Terminate or reduce this LNAPL body migration. Abate, reduce unacceptable soil vapor or dissolved phase concentrations that are coming from that LNAPL source zone. And then finally, aesthetic LNAPL concerns in terms of saturation. There's a Texas risk rules or something called the gunk standard. You don't want to be too high that your tractor sinks into the soil. But definitely aesthetics are a part of a lot of these different risk programs in there, and that's a piece on there. Brian, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I was going to say you can see that all of these specific bullets here are really just attempts to formulate metrics that are related to the overarching metrics, the NCP metrics, CERCLA criteria, RCRA criteria, the ideas of like reducing the toxicity and mobility of contaminants, the idea of achieving appropriate and relevant standards. But what we have is what around the country, a lot of people are attempting to formulate those into metrics where they're going to be responsive and measurable they're over certain time frames. And there's a lot of other work going on in ITRC. There's the integrated DNAPL source team. They're developing metrics. So I think what we're going to see over the next several years is lots of work on this area of setting site goals, where maybe what we'll get is to kind of a refined approach where we get interim goals and then final goals, and that's really where models are going to come in handy. So we'll explore this a lot more over the next several weeks. And what I'm going to do is
Brian, switch. You're going to transition, right?
Right. So this is really a diagram that Ron put together, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, but this is another example of taking and balancing the different kinds of metrics at a site and characteristics of a site and formulating remediation strategies. And these are not linked across. What they are is really up and down, and it's more like a slot machine where you can imagine that the different things are rotating around, and any combination can come up. So, for example, the kinds of questions you can ask to help you formulate strategies are things like, is most of the mass still in the source? Is some of it in the source and some in the plume? Or is most of the mass in the plume? Is the plume growing, stable, or shrinking? And these all use multiple lines of evidence the way that EPA describes in their various guidance documents. And then finally, and this ends up being a very overarching factor for plume remediation, how much plume remediation do you need? Do you need a factor of 10? Do you need a factor of 500? Do you need a factor of 10,000? And what we'll do over the next period of time is we'll come back and we'll kind of re-explore this diagram and what the ramifications of some of these things are. Because what you see is the blend of necessary source and plume remediation changes as a function of the answers to these questions and the complexity of the remediation changes in response to these questions. Ron, did you want to add anything to that?
I guess one thing that was a little bit surprising to us at the beginning when we really started first looking at this is how important that right-hand column is. If your source concentration is 10 times higher than some standard you're trying to reach, it's going to be pretty easy to reach that goal compared to if it's 10,000 times different. So that really makes it much, much harder when you have many orders of magnitude that you have to achieve. You really have to have a much better and more complete remediation to get there.
Right. So this is really a diagram. I'm going to go through these relatively quickly. The heart of today's session is to have Ron running in real time so that you can see it some of these tools. But this is a diagram I put together for the National Academy of Sciences back in about 1990, and we had some success developing and deploying and cleaning up sites. And so the National Academies called us, and they said, well, how do you do it? And so we sat down and we thought about it, and this is the conceptual model that we had been working from. What we did at the time, this was two decades ago now or a little more, we divided the site into three zones, which suspiciously looks a lot like what Ron did when he developed REMCOR. What you have is a kind of a near-field disturbed zone which has highly perturbed conditions. You have an impact zone that's been called the primary plume. That's an area with easily observable, detectable impacts. Then you have this transition or baseline zone. And this will occur on every site, whether it's a mom-and-pop gas station, a little dry cleaner, a large industrial site, a big Department of Defense or DOE site. So each of these zones has a different character. And one of the things that we have found is that in most cases for medium to large sites, what is often the best approach is to use the combined remedy and to match the character of the cleanup for each zone to the character of the contaminants there. So the need in the source zone is to eliminate or mitigate that disturbance by active engineered solutions. In the case of chlorinated solvents, that might be thermal or oxidant or some fairly intensive approach. In the case of hydrocarbons, it might be oxidant. The impact zone, this would be kind of the primary plume. This is pump and treat, bioremediation, permeable reactive barriers, things like that. The transition baseline zone, this would typically be something like a monitored natural attenuation. So this is what we put together for all of our sites, and then when we met with our regulators, we would put this diagram up, and then we would discuss with some specificity what our behaviors would be in each zone, and then there would be some spirited discussion about where to draw the edge of the zones. But by having a structure like this, it allowed us to have a very fruitful, positive conversation that went relatively rapidly and efficiently and effectively. Now, being an engineer, you can almost think about how this relates to cost and how it relates to characterization. So the technologies you use in the source zone are things that have to touch all of the contaminated material with either chemical or energy or some other material. So the costs are typically in engineering units of dollars per cubic yard or dollars per cubic meter or dollars per pound or dollars per kilogram. So what that means is that it's really important for you to understand exactly where your contaminant is, and this is this whole idea of understanding your source architecture and exactly where your contaminant is, because if you're paying in dollars per cubic meter of soil treated, you don't want to be treating cubic meters that aren't contaminated. So that kind of is the key there. For the primary plume, it's dollars per volume of water pumped or dollars per acre. Numbers like that, those are the engineering units. You need to understand your zone of capture. You need to capture plume cores instead of clean water. And then the dilute plume and the fringe, the engineering units are dollars per time. And that's where you really need to get into something where you understand exactly what's happening and what your metrics are in natural attenuation. So this is the conceptual model that we use. It's not the only one. It's not necessarily right, but it has been effective for our site. Now, what happens is in the real world, it's not beautiful ovals. So this is a diagram of a real-world plume, and the top of this box is about 2 square miles. This plume goes down to a depth of about 80 meters or so, and what you can see is you get this complex three-dimensional structure. This happens to be colored in the red, green, and blue, so it correlates with our ovals. And so what we have is our source treatments that are done in the red zone, our primary plume done in the yellow and green material, grading out to more natural attenuation style remedies. But this is the reason why in some cases you need a more complex model. This site would not necessarily be amenable to a simple model like REMCLOR because it's a complex three-dimensional plume. You can follow a plume core on REMCLOR, though, and it does a pretty good job even on a plume like this. Now, what we found, though, then is that in each of those zones, there's appropriate technologies. There's a continuum of technologies. So you can get source removal and treatment technologies, excavation, contaminant destruction, thermally enhanced removal. In the intermediate zone, you get pump and treat, recirculation wells, in-situ bioremediation. Then you get into this whole class of enhanced attenuation where you can get permeable reactive barriers, phytoremediation, and then monitored natural attenuation. And the whole trick of this is matching technology, matching the character and the personality of the technology to the character and personality of the zone being treated, and combining technologies where the strength of the remediation technology is playing into the strengths of other remediation technologies. And that occurs in both space and time. So what you have in a real world, you have a period where a source is out there. It begins, a plume begins to form, it expands. If there's attenuation occurring at all, then it'll eventually stabilize and shrink. And the idea is that you can accelerate that remediation performance by applying appropriate technologies. And so what we have here is this kind of simplified representation of groundwater changing in space and time overlaid on decision matrix where you match technologies. And so the game that one can play with a model like REMCLOR is you can quickly envision what these scenarios might look like, test them out, and really screen a large number of scenarios relatively quickly. So finally, I think we're going to switch over to Chuck, but what we then can talk about is coupling technologies in space, coupling technologies in time, and then thinking about intensive technologies followed by passive. So to you, Chuck.
Great. Thanks, Brian. And we're going to talk about technology coupling and just a brief introduction. We've got some slides from an ITRC course for this integrated DNA site strategy document. I was on this team. Najee Akletas from Maine was the our team lead, and a great document has a lot about decision-making coordinated solvent sites. But we spent a lot of time doing different things, and I've got 4 or 5 slides from them talking about a couple of these technology factors. And where this was really coming in is trying to think about how to assemble remedies together and then how to put these things together and simulate them in REMFUEL, REMCLOR. In this document on the DNEPL side, there says there are 3 types of this coupling, temporal, spatial, and simultaneous. The IDSS team, we said the most common approaches are some sort of intensive technology, say in a source zone followed by passive, or different technology for the source or plume, or many of these technologies then followed by M&A. We also go in there and talk about, again, this is all like a match.com in some ways in terms of likely couples and unlikely couples, and talk about which different technology combinations, you know, work well together and which ones maybe don't work together. And there's a lot of new knowledge about this. There was a conceptual model in the coordinated solvent world that ISCO, followed then by bio, might be incompatible. This is not proven to always be the case. So this document's got a lot of good information about sort of coupling on this and on the coordinated solvent side. Now on the fuel side, we've got the next slide here, and this is basically coming from the GeoTracker database from the report I talked about. From those 6,000 sites, those graphs I showed are really just any site with benzene, And just showing this record of all this benzene records over time, it wasn't stratified by if the source was removed or anything else, but it there was about 6,000 of those sites used to come up with that benzene curve, and there were 1,300 of the sites in GeoTracker that had information about their remediation technologies, and this is just this pie chart in here. So dual-phase extraction was 22.9%. Excavation was the most common, 41%. But if you look at this pie chart here, you quickly note that, you know, we get more than 100%. So there's quite a bit of technology coupling going on in the hydrocarbon world in terms of different mixes and matches of these different technologies in there. So that's also some of this information coming out of this GeoTracker database. Now let's talk about, that's technology coupling and assembling things. Now let's talk about something maybe a little more immediate, and that's what do you do about the situation you're running by REM fuel or you're running a REM core and you're looking at this thing. You've got to fill in. There's a window. It's the 8th data window down on the input. And if you want to simulate some sort of source remediation, what fraction do you remove? So now we're thinking about source remediation. How much mass can I get out of there? You put in a certain amount of mass at the start, say 1970. There's a certain amount that's slowed down below. And so one thing that this IDSS document, this ITRC document talks about are results from multiple site performance studies. So I've got this, the next couple of slides, really focused on chlorinated solvent sites and what these studies show. I think the strong point about these studies is that they're independent researchers. There's a careful, consistent before and after methodology for all the different sites. It's a consistent comparison, describes a spectrum of sites. It's real data. It's not anecdotal. It's actually what actually happened before versus after. And then there are several studies that were compiled and put into the IDSS document. Here's just a couple of them, some of them that I was the co-author on. But one of the units of currency that is in this particular ITRC document is the concept, what I call ohms, or orders of magnitude. And thinking about remediation is really an ohm type of business. We had a little bit of that in the homework problem. So why do we think about things in terms of these orders of magnitude? Well, we'll think about hydraulic conductivity. We say that's a 10 to the minus 3 sand, or it's a 10 to the minus 4 silt. Of course, I'm talking about centimeters per second. Think about the VOC concentration maps. Maybe you'll have 1 ppb, 10 ppb, 100 ppb, and up. So we think about that in terms of this log normal distribution. So here we think about remedy performance, and this is in section 4 of this ITRC document. A 90% reduction is, well, it's 1. It's 1 order of magnitude, what I call 1 ohm. 99.9% reduction is 3 ohms. 70% production, that's about half an ohm. So if we've got the before concentration of 50,000 micrograms per liter and the goal is a 5 microgram per liter, then for one single treatment to get that, you would need 4 ohms of reduction. So let's look at some performance data, and this is from data that's presented in the ITRC document, but presented in a different way. I'm always experimenting different ways to visualize data. So a lot going on here. Basically, on the x-axis, this is the average before remediation occurred at these chlorinated solvent sites, and that's in milligrams per liter from about 1 part per billion on the left to over 100 milligrams per liter. And this is a mixture of different types of sites, TCE, TCA, and then on the y-axis is the after remediation. I think it says average. These are actually geomeans, so these are geometric concentrations. So if you look at this and you start out, say, at the 1 milligram per liter, and then you move up here, and I'm going to sort of go, there's a green diamond right in here, and we start at about 1 milligram per liter. We end up at about 0.01 milligrams per liter. That's about a 99% reduction in concentration, or 2 ohms. So all these dots here are actual 59 different sites where people did some sort of remediation, either with bio, chemox, surfactants, or thermal, and it sort of shows where they started and where they ended. And so this is this type of performance data is in there to help people think about remediation and can be used, if you so choose, to enter in values into REMCore in terms of the performance of a particular remedy that you might think of. So just a little bit of data presentation, different dots in here, different patterns that are in there. I thought it was a good way to present this type of information. Now, in terms of the multiple site studies, I did want to say that the ITRC document says, you know, use caution with some of these, that a lot of times your own personal experience at a site is going to be much better than these multiple site studies. Technology vendors can provide a lot of good information. And these site studies, sometimes they're not site-specific. They're sort of, all of this is over many different types of hydrogeologies. They sometimes lump pilot scale and full scale for some of these studies. One point is they may not account for intentional shutdowns. They got to a 90% reduction and they stopped. They said that was good enough for some reason. They don't account for different levels of design experience, and we're a lot better now. So just a little bit of information on the chlorinated solvents world, some of the sprinkling of information about performance, and in specific, one source of possible information you can use to enter in the fraction removed in REMCLOR. And so with that, I think we, Ron, you want to add to that, or are we going to go to the questions now?
Yeah, this is Brian. I think that this is a very powerful idea, the idea of orders of magnitude. I think we need to be a little careful because there certainly is development in each industry, and remediations are improving over time. I think thermal is a good example where there's like one or two orders of magnitude reduction in the thermal in this graph. I think two is a probably reasonable now in a properly designed thermal, and some thermals have done better. They've gotten even three orders of magnitude. So, I think there is some uncertainty in this, but I think that what this does is it gives us a really good kind of comfort level that one can get one to three orders of magnitude reduction. And what that means is if that's not enough, if you do a source treatment and one to three orders of magnitude is not enough to achieve your overarching goals, then it's probably going to be required to combine that source remediation with some plume remediation. And once you make that mental leap of needing to do some plume remediation, then what it means is that maybe you can turn off the expensive source remediation when you get to your 2.5 orders of magnitude and not try to drive it all the way down. And I think that's where we can really support some more strategic decision making.
Okay, great. I just wanted to do a real quick time check. We're at 2 p.m. Eastern. Just would you like to try to take a few questions, or do you want to carry on?
Yeah, I think we're in good shape, so okay. We can take a few questions.
Okay. We did have, again, this is for those of you on the telephone lines. I'm going to go ahead and start with you first. If you are on the phone lines and have a quick question for one of our presenters, please feel free to unmute. You'll unmute by hitting #6, and feel free to ask your question out loud. Okay. Well, in the interest of time, I'm then going to go ahead and turn to some of those online questions that have been submitted. We did have one that was actually coming in regarding the homework assignment. Would you guys mind if we start with that one?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. This first question comes in from Andrew, and they basically mention that as far as the homework assignment goes, the steady state plume length may not decrease by 90%, but it does, in fact, reduce the length significantly, defined as the 0.01 isopleth. I don't know if you can comment on that.
I think that's the key point, is that the before picture, you had this plume as defined by this 0.01 isopleth was in the canal, and then you do this treatment, and then after the plume responds to that, which might take several years of travel time, but you get to a better condition, and it's not discharging into the plume. So even though it's not, I think the two messages are for, I would say, most of these plumes, there's not a one-to-one correspondence between removing a certain percentage source mass and reducing the plume length a certain percent. But there's certainly a lot of cases where you improve the situation.
Yeah, the thing that is roughly one-to-one is the plume mass. So if you start with 1,000 kilograms in the plume and you reduce the source strength by a factor of 10, you expect that to drop to 100. But the length of it really depends on how you define the plume. And if you define it by very low concentrations, it may not appear to shrink by all that much compared to if you define it by higher concentrations, it will appear to shrink quite a bit more. And we'll talk about sort of the reason why that is later on. There's a good explanation for that, but it takes a little while to explain it.
Okay. Let's take another question that's coming in. And I think you guys may have started to address this. Mary asks, what if fuels and chlorinated solvents are present? How do you model that?
Yeah, this is Brian. There's several ways you can do that. If you wanted to use these particular tools, the presence of the hydrocarbons would likely lead to anaerobic conditions, so you could account for that and make a central zone where you have more rapid chlorinated degradation and run REMCLOR. And then if you wanted to understand what was going on with the fuels, you would need to run RemFuel separately. So that would be one approach, and there are many others.
Now, another thing, the limitation of RemFuel is that you only have one daughter product, so it depends on what chlorinated solvent you have. But if it's a gasoline additive, like 1,2-DCA, it's made for that. So you would just run RemFuel, and you would include like ethylene dibromide and the 1,2-DCA as part of the constituents of the gasoline. So it just depends. If you need all four daughter products, though, then you probably want to run RemChlor and just account for the effect of the fuel on that degradation of the chlorinated solvents, or maybe run the two models.
Okay, great. We have another question that's coming in from Queenie on slide 23, and they ask regarding the sample pool for MTBE. Were they only sampling sites that have MTBE, or is it a broader pool?
Yeah, this is Chuck. So slide 23 is from the GeoTracker, and what Tom McHugh did was he looked for any site that had MTBE out there, and if that site had it, it got into this process of computing these six-month medians from all the data. So these this represents only sites that had MTBE in them. Now, the number of sites change over time. That's a key part about this graph, as it starts out at about 3,500 sites, and then it peaks at about 5,500 sites. And then the number of sites where you're seeing MTBE starts going down, starting about 2008. And so it's not just one consistent set of sites over time. This is this whole universe of sites with MTBE in California.
Okay, great. I have two questions that are coming in regarding the OOM or OOM reduction. The first asks you to define OOM or OOM reduction, and then the other one basically makes a statement that it appears that bioremediation has the highest OOM. Is that correct?
Yeah, so let's work on both of those. And so this order of magnitude is just, or OOM is the term I used, for how much percent reduction in concentration or source discharge that you get. So it's you could say, instead of one order of magnitude, you say it's a 90% reduction. If you could say if it's a 99.9% reduction, that's equal to three orders of magnitude. So it tries to leverage off this idea that it's a log normal world out there. It's a factor of 10 world, and so that if you're thinking about remediation, you're putting on this hat, you think I'm getting one, two, or three of these OOMs, or these factors of 10 reduction. I guess regarding the second question, going on to the map here, I think that there was one site out in here that bioremediation where there was 3.5 orders of magnitude in this geomean concentration. I think if you look at the whole stats together, in terms of the family sites, I think there are only six thermals up here, but they had the highest average OOM rate. So it had slightly higher performance if you bundle all these guys together. Just another note is that this is each one of these dots is the geomean of all the site concentrations. This is coming from this paper by Travis McGuire. That while you see this decrease in concentration, in some cases pretty substantial, the paper does say that each one of the sites below the MCLs, there was at least one well that was above. So a lot of these got very close to the standard of MCLs, and some of them have average site concentrations below that. But just trying to visually show what these technologies have done. Another note is we're trying to update this. So we're actually going to meet with some Jim Cummings and some of his crew next Tuesday, I think, get some data that he's got. We want to update this from 2006 and see, are we getting better? Are we getting more OOMs?
Okay, great. Let's take one more easy question online, and this one comes in from Don. He asks, does RemFuel account for the mole fraction control on solubility of COCs over time?
Yes, it does. Because we're tracking the mass of each constituent in the source zone, and we're relating the discharge or the concentration to the mass. And if you use a gamma exponent of 1, it's a 1-to-1 relationship, which is just like Raoult's law, mole fraction partitioning. So yes, it does do that.
Okay, great. I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and carry on with the presentation. We do have more time allocated for questions. For those of you that have questions still in the queue, don't worry. They have been saved, and we're going to try to get to them at our next break. And so, again, I would encourage you, type up those questions and comments in the Q&A pod as soon as they occur to you. The other thing, again, if you're having any technical problems or have any comments on the Adobe Connect pod, feel free to go ahead and use the Q&A pod to let me know what you're experiencing. Thank you.
Okay, so this is Ron. We're going to kind of shift gears a little bit now and start talking about some of the real details of RemCore today. Most of these things I'll talk about also apply to RemFuel. And let's start off with just a high-level view of how you use these. The first thing you have to do is figure out the input data. And every time that I've tried to do this, there are always things that you don't know. So there are going to be quantities you have to make an estimate on. Then you run the model and compare the results to the data, like a recent sampling event, or better still, a whole time series over the entire site. And then you go through this calibration process. So you adjust the model parameters to make the model fit the real data as best you can. And there are a lot of things that can be adjusted in the model, but the key ones in our experience are this initial source concentration, the C0, the initial source mass, which was at M0, the degradation rates in the plume, the lambdas, and then the velocity. And then the model's most sensitive to those. And the sensitivity depends on the particular site. Different combinations or different sites will be sensitive to one or the other parameter. And it's sort of hard to predict ahead of time what the most important one is, actually. So what I want to do next, before I actually have you run the model, is I want to just walk through a case that we did a couple years ago. A PhD student that's working with me, Hailian Lang, did this as part of her dissertation. This is a simulation of a real TCE plume in North Carolina. And this is in eastern North Carolina, this site, in the coastal plain. So it's Atlantic coastal plain sediments. It's a medium-sized manufacturing plant. They make Dacron polyester fibers currently, but they've made other things in the past. And in the late 1980s at this site, they discovered TCE contamination in the groundwater. And about the late 90s, this had formed a plume about 1,250 feet long that wasn't really growing much, but it wasn't shrinking either. So it was a medium-sized, stable plume. Now, like most cases, the details of the TC release are not known. The location's known pretty well, but the date's not known. But it was before 1980. The plant, I believe, was built in the late 50s. Now, this particular plume contains only TCE, just about. It doesn't have much cis DCE or vinyl chloride, so it doesn't appear that there's much biodegradation going on from these markers. The TCE is declining in concentration somewhat, but it's not producing these daughter products. The groundwater velocity is somewhat less than 100 feet per year. So the consultants who worked on this site back in the late 90s estimated the source zone mass at around 300 pounds. There's a lot of uncertainty in that number. Wells in this source zone near it have concentrations that fluctuate quite a bit, but they've been as high as 6,000 micrograms per liter. They did an active remediation at this site in the late 90s. In 1999, they did two main things. They did a zero-valent iron injection throughout the source zone, and they reported mass removal of 95%, or mass destruction of 95%. Now, when we look at the data from the wells, we haven't seen large reductions in concentration, so I would say there's probably a lot of uncertainty in that 95% removal number, and I'm not quite sure how it was calculated. Another thing they did, though, was to install a permeable reactive barrier down gradient of the source using also zero valent iron. This is 5 inches thick. It goes all the way through the source vertically, and it's about 300 feet downgrading of the source. And actually, that had a very big effect on the plume. So this is a picture of the site, a map of the site. The groundwater is flowing roughly to the north. This brown circle is approximately the source zone drawn to scale. This purple line, which is maybe a little bit hard to see, is the location of the permeable reactive barrier, that 5-inch thick barrier, but intensely reactive. And then these are different monitoring wells. And in the paper, we published a paper on this in groundwater monitoring and remediation back this past winter. But we looked at concentrations in most of the, or I think all of these wells, and that's what we were trying to match with REMCLOR, and we were trying to match those before and after the remediation. And by the way, if anybody wants a copy of that paper, you could send me an email and I can send you the PDF. I can't post it online because of copyright issues, but if somebody asks me for it, I can send them a PDF copy. So we have these parameters that are in REMCLOR, and I'll show you in a minute where they are in there, but you know, we have a handful of ones that we have to come up with numbers for. So the key ones here, initial source concentration, well, this value of 6,000 is what we saw in the source zone from the wells. Initial source mass, 300 pounds is what they said in the reports. That's 136 kilograms. The units in REMCLOR are all metric, by the way. The release date, well, we know it's before 1980 and after about 1957, but that's a case where we just had to pick a day sort of in between. We don't really know when it was. We used the exponent of 1. We did have pretty good information on the dimensions of the source zone, the width about 8 meters or 25 feet, and a depth of about 10 feet, 3.5 meters. The Darcy velocity at this site, now this is interesting. We had reports where they had estimated the velocity between 1.5 and 4.6 meters per year, and that was based on the hydraulic gradient and the result of slug tests. And we could never get the model to match the site data using those low numbers. The plume never grew fast enough. We had to double it. But and my student Hylion was bothered a lot by that. But in my view, if you're estimating Darcy velocity or groundwater velocity using slug tests, those could easily be a factor of 2 different from what it really is on the low side. But anyways, that's an example of where we had to calibrate that parameter, although we didn't, you know, go way out from what the estimates were. Porosity at 0.3. We estimated the retardation factor at 2. That's a moderate value. And then these dispersivities. And these may look a little different from what you're used to. X is distance from the source, and so we're saying the longitudinal dispersivity is 1/20th of the distance. So we're using scale-dependent dispersivities here. And that's kind of a feature of this model, is that we generally use scale-dependent dispersivities. The longitudinal dispersivity is the biggest one. The transverse one is somewhat smaller. And these two, we calibrated these to match the plume. The other key parameter here is the decay rate of TCE. And the calibrated value is a low decay rate. This is a half year of 5.5 years, a half life of 5.5 years. So the TCE is decaying very gradually in this plume. So that's sort of the natural attenuation part of it. But now, what about the remediation part? Well, there's two aspects to that. There's the source remediation up here in the top. So the reported value was 95%. So that's what we put in. So we said in 1999, 95% of the mass that's remaining in the source is going to be gone. But then we have this permeable reactive barrier, and this is something Brian alluded to. You know, we think of these space-time zones of the plume reactions as being fairly big zones where we put some chemicals in, but there's no real limitation to their size. So you can actually simulate something like a thin permeable reactive barrier. If you look at this blue area down here, so this is the source zone at zero. You go 89 meters down, we start the permeable reactive barrier, and it's 12.7 centimeters thick. That's 5 inches. So we actually have a zone here that's 5 inches thick in RemCore that's going to represent that permeable reactive barrier, and that barrier is going to start operation in 1999, and we just sort of arbitrarily had it end in 2029. So the way we're representing that barrier in here is by giving that little blue zone a very high reaction rate, a very high decay rate. If you go through the mathematics and look at how long it takes for a molecule of TC to go through that 5 inches, this gives you about 90% removal with that kind of half-life of 14 hours. So here's the simulation output. So we start this simulation in 1967. The plume is growing. It's moving down gradient. It's encountering most of these wells. And this is the snapshot of it right before remediation. So this is just a pure natural attenuation case. And I've contoured this out to 5 parts per billion here. So in the next picture, it's 2 years after the remediation. So two things have happened here. We've taken 90% of the mass out of this source zone, and then we've put this permeable reactive barrier in. And what you'll notice is that reactive barrier has chopped the plume off. It's caused it to separate or detach. The concentrations aren't zero in this blank area, but with a 5 ppb contour, it appears that it's detached. So you see a definite effect of the permeable reactive barrier, but of course the plume's not cleaned up because it takes time for these effects to sort of wash downstream. If we go forward to 2009, you see much more of an effect. Now this part of the plume is completely detached from the source area, and the concentrations are decaying away because they're no longer being fed from the source. And what you'll notice upgrading of the PRB wall is that these concentrations are also much lower than they used to be, and that's the benefit of the source remediation. So the loading to the PRB wall is now much lower, and then downgrading of the PRB wall, the plume is attenuating. So in the journal paper, we compared the simulation results to the real data for, I think, all of the wells that are shown in red here. And so if you want to see that, you can look at the paper. But here's a few of the key ones. So well MW59 is downgrading of the source zone but upgrading of the permeable reactive barrier. So in the simulation, the release starts in 1967. It takes a few years to see the concentrations at that location because of the time forced to evect that far, and then the simulation predicts a pretty constant concentration. Now, at that location, we start having data, it looks like, about 2005. And so we don't know what it was before then, but it's matching the model pretty well. Now, you see the concentrations start to decline here somewhere around 2005. That's when the effect of the source remediation that happened in 1999 reaches that downgradient location. So it takes a few years to go downgradient before you see it. Well, MW29 is the most interesting one here. It is about, I think, 20 or 30 feet, maybe a little bit more, downgrading of the permeable reactive barrier there. So in that one, they started collecting data in the late 80s, and they've been collecting it continuously. So we have the simulation results here in blue, and we show the contaminant, the TC, hitting that in the late 70s. The concentrations are comparable to what we see in the data. And then right here at 1999, we immediately see a drop because of that permeable reactive barrier. And we're seeing a drop of a factor of 10 here, and that's related to that rate that we put in there. That high decay rate in the barrier gave us a factor of 10 drop as the water passes through there. And then we see kind of a plateau, and then we see another drop that looks like this one. And that is a result of the lower loading coming from the source. So it's a kind of a, you see two waves move through there, one from the PRB wall and one from the source remediation. And then finally, this downgradient well, it takes longer to get there and then longer for the effects of the plume and source remediation to be seen there, but the simulation predicts that sometime in the last few years, we should see the concentration starting to drop. So that's just sort of an example of how you would apply this. Oftentimes, we would apply this to a site without remediation, so we would just have the early data, you know, back here where these are mostly straight lines, but then we would be trying to forecast, you know, what's going to happen, perhaps, if I do this or that kind of activity. So to summarize this up, and I think we've showed this slide, RimChlor and RimFuel allow you to simulate a release, and you can wait any time, any number of years before remediation, or you can have just pure natural attenuation. In the plume, there are three zones in space. You can manipulate those in time as well. And you do that by increasing the degradation rates over specific space and time periods. And in the end, the plume responds to this combination of factors. So there's always a certain amount of natural attenuation, both in the source and in the plume. You can do plume remediation. The source decays, and that term is a little bit confusing, but the source is being flushed out. So mass is being flushed out of the source. That causes it to become weaker. The source may also be undergoing some kind of chemical destruction, perhaps, and that could be an additional form of decay. And then you can do active source remediation. So we can simultaneously look at all of these effects, but in a fairly convenient way. So finally, we're going to try to fire up the model here. And I think the best way to do this, if you have two computers or two monitors, you could keep the Adobe on one and then keep watching what I'm doing on one of them. But you should try to open up RimChlor yourself on the other one. And so let me first talk about the problem while you're trying to get that set up. Let me talk about the problem we're going to look at. This is a purely hypothetical case that I made up, but it's a fairly simple one, but it'll illustrate how the model works. So let's say we had a 200 kilogram release of the chemical 1,2-dichloroethane that happened back in 1980. And let's say the initial source concentration is 1 milligram per liter. The groundwater is moving pretty quickly, 60 meters per year, so a couple hundred feet per year. We have a moderate level of degradation of DCA in the plume. It's degrading to, in this simulation, to chloroethane, but with a half-life of 2 years. And as you'll see, when we run that, we start the release in 1980, and we run it, we get this plume in 2010. Now, you won't see a picture like this in RimChlor. I did this with another program called TechBlot, but you can make one like this with a commercial program like TechBlot or Surfer using the output from RimChlor. But anyways, this plume grows and then stabilizes around the year 2000, and if you go forward into the future, like to 2008, the plume looks almost identical to what it looked like in 2000. So it's stable, which is good. It's not going to get any bigger, but the bad thing about that is that it's not going to go away for quite a long time either. So in terms of this slot machine table, we would characterize this one, this plume or this site, as having the mass is mostly in the source zone. And I say DNAPL here, but you know, if it was LNAPL, it would pave the same way. The plume is not growing anymore. It's stable. And in terms of the concentrations, we have about 1,000 parts per billion in the source zone, and we need to get down to a few parts per billion in the plume. So it's not exactly 500, but that's sort of the order of magnitude. So it's not one of these easy ones that's only 10, but it's also not a 10,000. It's kind of in between. So what we're going to do here first is to run RimChlor without any source or plume remediation and just see what will happen, see if it goes away in another 10 years or it will still be there in 50 years. The source is going to be getting weaker every year because we're washing it out into the plume, but in this case, it's happening slowly. Now, in other cases, the source may wash out quickly, and it would be completely different than this. The source could wash out in just a few years, depending on the characteristics of the chemical and the hydrogeology. So you just have to see. So this is where I want to switch. This is the RemCore input screen, and I'm going to move out of PowerPoint now. I already have RemCore, of course, installed on my computer, and I already have it opened up. So if you're going to open it up, you would go onto it here and right-click it and run it as administrator. So when you open it up, this is the opening page on it. And I guess the first thing to look at is, how do we get started? How do we start with a file? Now, in this window here on the left-hand side, you'll see several different projects. And RemCore comes packaged with these tutorials 1 through 8. Each one of those is a different problem. And if you click on one, it'll open up a populated input window. So it's ready, that model is ready to run in that case. So you could just go ahead and start with one of those. And those tutorials are described in quite a lot of detail in the user's manual. And by the way, to get to the user's manual, you go to Help, User's Manual. It opens up this PDF. And here's the user's manual. It's 80 pages almost, so I'll just keep that handy. Now, another way to start off would be you could do a new project. I don't really think I've ever done that because I've always started with an existing one and modified it, and that's probably the easiest thing to do. So normally you would take an existing project, modify it, and then save it as something else. Now, another thing you can do is open a project, and this will prompt you to go and look for the project. And all that RemCore needs are these files that end, they're called .rch files. They're these little text files that contain the key information to start off a simulation. So if you run a RemCore simulation and save it, it'll save this .rch file, and you can email that to somebody else, and they can run that file for themselves. And it's only a few kilobytes, so it's very easy to email it. But there are two files that I wanted to look at for this exercise, and I think these were available on the website. Right, Jean?
They are indeed. They're found on the resources page. I've also got those very same files available in the right side. There's a new pod that's appeared called the Files pod, and you'll see those two RemCore files available. You can just click on them, and there'll be a button that says Download Files. You can actually save them locally to your computer to use for the exercise.
Yeah, so go ahead and do that. And, of course, I already have them on my computer. So when you do this open command, it opens up just a typical browse window, and so I'll just have to hunt around on my computer and find where I put this file. But you all know how this works. You know, you got to remember the path, and you got to navigate to it, and if it's down a long tree like this, it takes you a little while, but I'm getting close. Module 2. So here are the two files, basecase.rch and sourcemediation.rch. You see, they're only 7 kilobytes. They're tiny files, so you can email those easily. So that's the one I want to open. And when I open that, now I have this project called Basecase, and it's filled in all the input boxes here on the RemCore page.
And Ron, this is Brian. I think this is an appropriate time. It's a little hard to see when you leave all of the pods up there. So the full screen button on the top is a toggle. So if you hit it once, it goes full screen. If you hit it again, it goes back down. And it looks much better when you go to full screen.
Yep. And I tried to make the background on my computer a little simpler. So this is Clemson Orange, if you were wondering why I chose that. So the input here is divided into about a half a dozen key areas, and I'll try to walk through each of these. But a lot of these parameters are hopefully kind of familiar to you by now. So we start at the top with the source parameters, and that source concentration is a key one. And with all these parameters, if you move the mouse over the variable, it'll give a little blurb about what it is and what the units are. If you need more information, you can go to the help, and it's a searchable help. So you could go in here, and you could look up input variables, and you could go to source parameters, and it would give you a little bit more information. And if you want still more information, you should go to the user's manual, which has the most complete information of all. So we've already talked about these parameters. The units here on the source concentration are grams per liter. So we had 1 milligram per liter, so that's 0.001 grams per liter. That source mass in this example was 200 kilograms. The exponent gamma, we picked 1. I didn't mention this, but the source width was 10, a depth of 3. The Darcy velocity, that's just the Darcy flux. So the actual pore velocity is the Darcy velocity divided by the porosity. But we need both of those because the Darcy velocity is used in the source term to figure out how much mass is flushing out, and the pore velocity is used in the plume to figure out how fast it's going. Now, we have a section here about source remediation, but in this first simulation, we're not going to do any source remediation. So the main thing is we want to leave that as zero. We're not removing any of the mass. The times here are not really relevant if we're not doing any kind of source remediation. Now, if we had a chemical that was undergoing some kind of decay, some kind of chemical decay or biological decay in the source zone, we could put a decay rate in here. But we'll say that the 1,2-DCA is not undergoing any kind of source decay other than being flushed out of the source zone. Here's where we have the retardation factor, and we picked a value of 2. So far, probably this seems straightforward, but this next parameter has, I've found, been confusing to people, and it's because of the way I set this up to begin with, unfortunately. The way the program works is with a bunch of stream tubes, and the way it gets dispersion is by letting each stream tube go at a different velocity. And to make it look like dispersion, those velocities have a normal Gaussian distribution. So a way of characterizing that dispersion is with the standard deviation of the normal distribution. And so that's what that sigma v is. It's the standard deviation of the velocity divided by the mean velocity. Well, that's not something that groundwater people, they don't normally speak in those terms, but that's how it's programmed here. So the good news is that that gives you exactly scale-dependent dispersion. And if you go in the manual, the best way to understand this is to look around page 40 of the manual where it describes that. If you pick this sigma V, the standard deviation of the stream tubes, it corresponds to a scale-dependent dispersivity. And so this table on page 41 is, I think, the key to understanding that. If you pick a value of 0.447, that gives you a scale-dependent dispersivity of 1/10 of the travel distance. If you pick a value for that sigma V of 0.1, it gives you a scale-dependent dispersivity of 1/200th of the travel distance. And this would be roughly the range over, you know, that we think is, most people think is reasonable to use for that longitudinal dispersivity. Okay, now these V min and V max, that just has to do with how the normal distribution is sampled. So as long as you have a, you could use a value of 0 on this side and 1.5 to 2 on this side, and there's some guidance on that, but the model's not too sensitive to those. But this next one is pretty important, the number of stream tubes, because that's what's giving it the dispersion in this model. And the temptation would be to use a lot of them, like a few thousand. And that's great. You'll get a nice-looking answer, but the model is going to run slower. So the fewer stream tubes you have, the faster this model is going to run. But you have to be careful, because if you don't have enough, you'll have kind of a sawtooth pattern in the output. And that's alarmed people in the past, and the cure was to add more stream tubes. So for some problems, you might use 100. Other problems, you might use 1,000, but normally in that range to give you kind of a smooth average of the different velocities. Now, these next two here are the transverse dispersivity and the vertical dispersivity. And there's a choice there. You can use a constant value, or you can have a scale-dependent value. And we almost always use scale-dependent values. And you're probably wondering why there's a minus sign there. Well, that's kind of an old-fashioned programmer's trick. If you want to use something as what we call a flag, as like a switch, you can give it a minus sign. And then the program can say, oh, I see a minus sign. I know what you mean by that. So what it means when you put this minus sign in is that that's going to be a scale-dependent dispersivity. And again, this is described here in the manual. Down here, if a negative number is entered, dispersivity is calculated as the absolute value of that times the distance. So what that means is that what I'm really going to get here is a transverse dispersivity that's 1/1,000th of the travel distance. So this value is corresponding to 1/100th of the travel distance, and now I'm specifying 1/1,000th of the travel distance for the transverse dispersivity, and then 1/10th of that for the vertical dispersivity. So I know that that has been a little bit confusing to people in the past, but if you look at it in the manual, and hopefully it'll make sense. Now let's look at this really important section for the plume. Here's the matrix that we've talked about, where you enter in those rates. All the rates can be the same. So for this simulation we're doing now, we're just having natural attenuation. We're not manipulating the plume in any way. We don't have to have different rates in each different zone, but we could. But you define this matrix by giving it distances, which on this example don't really matter, but if we were going to want to specify a treatment zone, it would matter. And you give it times. And again, it's distance from the source and time from the date of the release. And it goes up to infinity. In REMCore, we have four components. So component number one, I'm up at this tab here. That's the parent compound that's coming out of the source zone. And in this case, it's 1,2-DCA. That is going to decay into a daughter compound, which in this simulation is chloroethane. And then we're not going to worry about anything beyond that. So it didn't really enter anything for component three or four. But for something like PCE, we would have it go through the whole chain. This number up here is the yield. So that's the yield of chloroethane from 1,2-dichloroethane. And that is assuming an equal or a molar conversion. So that's just the ratio of the molecular weights, because we're using mass units in REMCore, and the molecular weight of chlorine is much higher than hydrogen. So again, if we just want to have the same rate, we could put all the same numbers in each of these boxes. Another way we could do that would be to make these numbers very large distances, so make them larger than anything the plume would encounter, make this time higher than anything the plume would encounter, but it doesn't really matter how you do that. These cancer risk parameters, these are cancer risk slope factors, but we're not going to use them on this problem, so I'm not going to talk about that until probably next time. So then let's talk about the bottom part here, the simulation parameters. This is an analytical model, so we can actually get an answer at any point in space and any point in time. A numerical model, you have to have all of the space divided up, so that you have an answer everywhere in space, and you have to march through all the times to get to a particular time. That's a sort of a disadvantage of numerical models. With analytical models, you can just jump to any location at any time and say, what's the answer at this location and this time, and get it. So what this is requesting here are what locations and what times do you want to know the answer. And you can pick a lot of locations and a lot of times, or just a few. The more you pick, the slower it's going to run. But it just depends on what you want. So we always want pretty much something in the x direction. So that's the direction of flow. You can pick up to 200 points in the x direction. Don't start at zero. Start slightly greater than zero, because the model can't evaluate it right at zero. The maximum value here would just be how far out do you want to look, and normally you'd pick this to be beyond the edge of the plume. Now, in the y direction, you can do this a couple of ways. If you are interested in making contour plots like the ones I showed a little while ago, then you should pick 40 or 50 y direction values and spread them out on either side of the center line. So the center line would be y equals 0. So if you go to the left, that's minus 60. And if you go to the right, that's plus 60, or in this example. But if you don't plan to make a contour plot, you could change that. You could just say, I only want one, and I just want it to be at 0. And that's what we would normally do for a center line plot. And the advantage of that is that it'll run 40 times faster than otherwise. I'll show you that in a minute. Let me go back to the way it was, though. Minus 60 and 60. And actually, this model is three-dimensional, so you could do the same thing in the Z direction. But it does assume only dispersion in one Z direction. So you have to imagine that we have one of two cases. We either have the contaminant sort of at the water table, and that is dispersing downward, or we have it on the bottom of the aquifer, and it's dispersing upward. So the way it's programmed, it's just going in one direction or the other. On the time, you pick the number of intervals, and you pick a starting time and ending time again. So here, it'll give me a set of these concentrations every 2 years. So once you have everything in here the way you like it, you should always save it, and you should probably save it fairly often just in case something happens. But then to run it, you go to Model, and you run. And you'll see this kind of old-style command prompt window come up. This one's going to take about 20 seconds because I asked for so many points in space. It would run much, much faster than that. So it finished. So we hit OK, and now we're ready to look at the output. And there's a few ways to do this, but they're specified right here. The classic way to look at it is the output versus distance. That brings up a pretty nice X or concentration versus distance plot. And this is right along the center line right now, but I can move it over if I want to. So here I have all the components that were in the simulation and also the total, but I can click different ones on and off down in this box. So let's click some of these off and just look at the DCA. I can copy this graph to the clipboard and paste it into a Word document. I can save it as a file somewhere if I like. I can save the style of this and open it up later. So this is a pretty nice graphing program. One thing I typically do is go in, right-click on this axis, right-click and hit Properties, and change the dimensions of that axis, because I don't really care about concentrations of 10 to the minus 2 parts per billion. So I'll change that to 1. And I guess something I should mention, these units are micrograms per liter here. So that source concentration was grams per liter, but on this graph, it's micrograms per liter. So what we're seeing here is the concentration along the center line of the plume 2 years after the release. And so if I want to watch that evolve over time, I can highlight 2 years, and I can just move down through here. So I'm just going down through here with the mouse. Actually, you can use the arrow down key. And so I'm pressing the down arrow key, and I'm just moving through time. So let me go back up again. This is kind of like watching a movie. We're moving 2 years at a time. So in 2 years, the plume's very small. You see it growing very quickly for the first 10, 12 years. Around year 20, it stabilizes. And now it's just a stable plume. If you look very carefully, you can see it dropping slowly, but pretty much the plume is stable. And even if I go all the way out to 100 years, it's really hardly dropped. So that simulation would show us that natural attenuation in this case will lead to a plume that stabilizes and doesn't grow anymore, but at the same time, for all practical purposes, it's not shrinking much either. Now, there are some other graphs here that you can look at. We're not going to talk about the cancer risk today. So let's look at this one called mass discharge. Now, the way that's defined is that if you go any distance down gradient of the source and draw a line perpendicular to the groundwater direction, so like a property line or a creek or something where you want to know the discharge, the number here on the y-axis is the total kilograms per year crossing that plane. So if the plume is discharging into a river, let's say at 235 meters here, you could predict what the discharge into that river is going to be. So again, you can click off on and off the components. Let's just look at the DCA and see when it starts discharging into that river at 235 meters. So again, I can go up here and I can march down through these. It looks like after 8 years, it's discharging into that hypothetical river. The value here would be 0.12 kilograms per year. And we could look at it evolve over time. So it looks like it stabilizes, as you would expect, at about that value, and then only declines very slowly after that. So that's one way to look at the output here.
Ron, this is Gene. I just want to do a quick time check for you. It's coming up on 2:55 Eastern.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, I think we're in pretty good shape, actually. Now, you'll notice another one here, 2D contour. That's a feature in this program, but it doesn't, in my opinion, work all that well, so I really don't use that one. If I want to make 2D contour plots, I go to this. Well, there's another way to do this, but there's a file output here. So when the model runs, it's creating a bunch of files that you can access with Excel or with text process, you know, word processors or with graphing programs. And these are going to be located in the directory where you had the input file. So wherever that .rch file was, that's where these files are going to be put. But the ones that you would want to look at, if you wanted to make contour plots, for example, would be like this remclor.csv. That's a comma-separated file. It has all the information from all the locations at all the times. So this is the information at time equal 2 years. This is the x-coordinate, the y-coordinate, the z-coordinate. These are the values of the four concentrations. And then if I scrolled over, that would be the total. And then, so this would be a two-dimensional snapshot at every one of those 50 times. And this is in a format that you can read into something like Surfer to make contour plots. So that may be of interest to some of you. But let's kind of move on. So when you're done, you can close the project, probably want to save it, and that kind of thing. So just quickly here, let's look at what that would look like. So this is the simulation I just ran, and the plume, I used that 2D data to contour using a program called TechPlot, but you go out 100 years and the plume looks almost the same. So the high concentrations have shrunk a little bit, the low concentrations really haven't, and on this discharge versus mass diagram, we've only moved down about one quarter of the way on here, on this particular one. So what we want to do next is try source remediation, and let's look at a case where we take out 90% of the source. between 2010 and 2011. And we could also do plume remediation, but for now let's just look at the source remediation. So I'm going to go back to RemClor. And I could do this two ways. I could make just minor changes to the base case file, or I can open up the source remediation one. And again, you'll have to navigate to it. But I have it right here, so I'm just going to open up the one I have nearby. But that's one of those two files that you had available to you. So the key point I want to make on this, to simulate source remediation, we take that last example, and we only change these three numbers. In the source remediation section here, we want to take 90% of the source out, so that's 0.9. We want it to happen starting in 2010. Well, that's 30 years from 1980, and it takes a year, so we'll end it in year 31. That's all you need to do for this simulation. I'm going to change this, though. I'm going to just do one value here. And then I'm going to run it. And so you see that one ran in about a half a second, so it was much faster. And now if we look at the output versus distance, we can look at this again, and it's going to look about the same. So as I toggle down, this problem is the same out until 30 years. So when I get to year 28, it looks exactly like that last natural attenuation simulation did, even year 30. But now look what happens. When I go to year 32, we drop that mass by a factor of 10. It drops that concentration by a factor of 10. And as we go forward in time, that effect washes down through the plume. So eventually it stabilizes it at that lower level. So I think that's kind of the run-through. I encourage you to run this on your own. You can't break it. You know, run any parameters you want and just see what happens with it. The tutorials, I think, or I hope, are useful. So these are the ones that are built in that you should see on your screen. And there's a pretty detailed description of each of those in the user's manual. And later on in the next few weeks, we'll be talking about these other tutorials, especially 6, 7, and 8. So if you want to look ahead and get familiar with those, it would be helpful. So to again look at that graphically, this was the DCA plume before remediation. We took out 90% of the source in 2011, so we jumped from up here somewhere to down here. That caused the source to be much weaker. It caused the plume to detach. So on that centerline plot, the concentration drops, and then it goes up, and then it drops again. On the contour plot, you see a separation of these contours, so you get detached plumes typically. And then if we look at the late time, we see a much smaller plume, although there still is a plume, but it's much weaker and much smaller. If we looked at the discharge, we would see the same kind of thing. This is before remediation, and then after remediation, we have this wave moving through the system, and then after that washes out, it re-stabilizes at a lower value. So for this particular case, it's pretty obvious, I think, but the plume doesn't instantly respond to source remediation. It takes a little bit of time for that effect to wash downstream. And it's common that you will see for a period of time a detached plume when you do source remediation. And unless the source treatment is perfect, and by that I mean 100% removal, there's still going to be some kind of a plume, but it will definitely be smaller. And whether it's small enough or not just depends on what's acceptable and how high it was to begin with. So with that, I think we're getting close to running out of time, but on my watch we have about 3 o'clock.
Yep, we can go ahead and take another 5 minutes or so to try to answer some questions, and then we'll go ahead and close things out. I'm going to turn to those of you on the telephone lines again. If you're on the phones and you have a question you'd like to ask out loud, please feel free to take yourself off of the global mute by hitting #6. And then feel free to identify yourself and or organization and ask your question. Okay. Well, if I don't hear anybody on the phone lines, I'm going to go ahead and start in on some of the electronic questions. You can continue to type up your questions for our presenters, and we'll continue to queue them up. And for those of you, again, who are commenting on asking our speaker to actually blow up or magnify the RemCore software program, even if he maximizes the program, it doesn't make the font any bigger. So you really need to use that full screen button in Adobe Connect. The other option, next to the full screen button, you may see two little boxes. If you pick the rightmost box of those two, it'll actually zoom in on the content that's being displayed, and you may find that that along with the full screen helps you zoom in to look at everything. So this first question I'm going to start with comes in from John. And John asks, can the model simulate back diffusion of VOCs from the aquifer matrix into groundwater as treated water migrates down gradient from a PRB?
That is a limitation of the model. In the source zone, we can approximately simulate that through a choice of a high gamma, but the plume model is a conventional advection dispersion model, so it does not have back diffusion at this time. It's something that we've been talking about, maybe adding to a future version, but not at this time.
So Ron, this is Chuck. Would you say that the results are optimistic in the plume if you have a hydrogeologic setting that has a lot of back diffusion in it?
Well, it depends, because back diffusion actually slows the plume down some, but it spreads it out over time. So whether that's good or bad, I guess, depends. But it
overestimate concentrations while the plume is expanding, but then maybe underestimate the concentrations if the plume is shrinking. That sound
right?
Yeah,
I think that's accurate.
And Chuck, this is Brian. I think the other thing is that comes into play more as you get into the very low concentration. So first order effects are probably pretty good until you get one or two orders magnitude.
And then I'll just put in a sales pitch for a new tool that's coming out from ESTCP, and Dr. Shalafar has the lead author. The Matrix Diffusion Toolkit should be out by the end of the year, and another free software tool. Two very simple matrix diffusion models to help analyze this process.
Excellent. Our next question comes in from Jerry, who asks, why increase in concentrations for last sampling point for monitoring wells 59 and 29?
In the real data, I guess?
I believe so, yeah.
What we see at that site and what we see at many sites is that the real data are very noisy. I think part of that is from what's happening underground, but I think part of that also is from the sampling process itself and from the analytical process. But at least my experience, when we look at real data over time, they tend to be fairly noisy, easily varying by a factor of two and sometimes by more than that. I know Brian and Chuck have looked at a lot of this, too.
Yeah, this is Chuck. There's, two large CERTA projects, and we were working on one of them to look at variability, and so there's a couple of papers coming out on that. And some of the thoughts are that some of the factors that may contribute to this are not uniform on where you put your sample intake, and so one thing is to be very consistent about that. The other is that at some sites there may be some of these thermal effects where during the hot summer months, those wells can get really stratified, and if you don't break that stratification, then you can get these very different results in a well. And then the last is just the subsurface like that is this reactor with a billion tiny baffles in it, so it just doesn't mix very much. Stuff just doesn't distribute down there very easily, and it's the nature of the beast. You'll see that variability, that noise in that data.
And this is Brian, so let me just weigh in one more time. The plumes are, in fact, the words plume cores have been used, but they're going through semi-preferential paths, and they're responding in real time to boundary conditions. The simplest example is, near a stream boundary where water levels are going up and down, and you can imagine water basically the shifting in its directions in response to that. But that's occurring at some level in all aquifer systems. So in addition to just sampling and all these other things, you get variability just associated with this constantly shifting driving forces on the edges of the plume. Now, a simple model like REMCOR isn't able to handle all that, but the idea here is to lump those things together so you can get your mind wrapped around kind of the broad response of the system to actions that can be taken in a variety of combinations.
Okay, great. Let me take a few more questions online. The next one's going to come in from Alan, who's asking, in reference to slide number 51, what data were used for calibration?
Ron, those are the ones with three monitoring wells, and you were just trying to get curves from the model to match the red dots the best you could. Is that right?
Actually, we used all the wells on here, so not just the three. So we used all the time series from all of the wells and tried to simultaneously match all of them with a single set of parameters.
And so it looks like you got a good match on that middle one, the 51, the down gradient one. It seems like that maybe the model is dipping down below, but these are sort of the matches you get in a real system like this. And and what you guys were doing is trying to do a bunch of wells and sort of get this middle fit, and pretty much done by trial and error looking at these different things.
It was, yeah, Hylion, yeah, did this. But if you get the journal paper, it shows the results for all these wells, I think. So they're all comparable. I mean, you know, none of them are perfect, but they're all reasonably close.
And I think that you just actually may have hit on another question we received from Carl, who asks you to please cite the article that you wrote and discussed earlier.
I think the reference would be back here. The first author is Lang, L-I-A-N-G, and it was in Groundwater Monitoring and Remediation in the winter of 2012.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Our next question is actually going to come in from Mary, who asks, what would the most appropriate gamma be for a heterogeneous site, 1 or 2?
This is Brian. 2 is actually pretty high. I like to, if I have a heterogeneous site, think of it as being between 1 and 2. I like to think of it maybe as 1.5 is a reasonable number, and then bound it with 1 and 2. But there's all different choices that could be made on that.
It depends, though,
yeah,
because I've done simulations with a highly heterogeneous site, and it just depended on where I put the NAPL. If I put the NAPL in the hypermeability zones, it responded like a gamma of 0.5. And if I
yeah,
put
exactly.
it in the low permeability zone, it looked more like a gamma of 1.5 or 2. So
and then, go ahead, Ron.
I'd be inclined to pick 1 most of the time.
And then just to throw out some more information in there. My colleague here at the GSI, Amitay Debasi, got an article in JCH with a synthetic source zone and looked at the gammas at different times, and it did change over time. But we got some pretty big gammas of matrix diffusion type sources after the DNAPL had been depleted. This is after about 40 years of washing the DNAPL out, greater than 2. So that matrix diffusion process in theory, this was more of a theoretical study, gave us some gammas greater than 2. So I think we're still learning a lot about gammas and what they mean and how to represent them at sites. Just going to a site by itself, it's sometimes hard to know what it is. And that's why a good default number would be 1 if you don't have any other information on the chlorinated sites.
But Chuck brought up a good point. It probably does change in time. It probably tends to increase as a source weathers and diffuses. So the model doesn't allow it to change in time, but you can, if it's an older source, you can put in the larger value to represent the time period that you're more interested in.
Okay, great. Our next question is going to come in from Jim, who asks, how would you calculate the yield coefficient if there are more than one degradation pathways for a parent compound?
Well, you have to – go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that if you have to just figure out what percent of that parent product is going to the next, to the daughter product, the next compound down the line, and then you would adjust it. So if it's 50% that's going to cis-DC or something else, and 50% going somewhere else, then you would just take the yield number divided by half, I think. Is that right, Ron?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, the units of the yield number are, is it grams per gram, or is it mole per mole? Or?
Well, it's just, it's mass, but it's dimensionless.
Yeah, okay, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're going from, yeah, grams to grams.
Yeah, okay.
And that's why the, that's why in, if 100% of it goes, it's the ratio of the molecular weights, because it's actually one
yeah.
mole going to one mole.
That's what
so
I'm sort
half,
of yeah.
if half the moles go over, it's just the molecular weight and, you know, changed by a factor of two.
Yeah.
Divided by two, yeah.
Okay. We have another question that came in from Mike, and Mike would like to know if the site was sampled for 1,4-dioxane.
I believe it was, but I don't know that for a fact.
Okay. Okay.
They don't
just a
have,
side note. Go ahead, Ron.
I don't think they have a history of TCA at that site. It's more TCE.
And this is Chuck. Just another note is we're looking at dioxane in the GeoTracker database and see when it appears and what it's doing. And so there's some interesting, you know, data in that. If you can compile all that stuff, there was this very few hits before, you know, a certain year. Then all of a sudden, it came out. You have to look for this stuff, and it shows up in a number of wells.
And of course, the analytical method wasn't really developed until fairly recently. I mean, the good analytical method. So,
great. We have another user, Matt, who is asking, how does REMCOR differ from, I believe, another model called BioBalance?
This is Chuck. So BioBalance is something that we developed along with Brian Looney, and they have different some similarities and some differences. I think the key thing is that REMCOR allows you to do remediation, while BioBalance is primarily natural attenuation.
Right, and BioBalance... Go ahead, Chuck.
Did I say that right?
Yes.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say BioBalanced is adds in some modules that focus on the electron donor and the electron acceptor relationships. So it's really more exploring something different. And that's the beauty of these various practical models that are out there is that one of them was developed for a reason. So what you do is you look at the need for your site and you look at the reason that each of these models was developed, and it may be that one of the models provides some unique kind of information that's useful to you. I would say something more equivalent to REMCOR is BioClore, wouldn't you, Chuck?
They've got BioClore has a source decay term. It has these different reaction zones in there. But BioClore is only for natural attenuation. You can't go in there and pull out some of the mass.
Right, and so the beauty of REMCOR is it in essence takes some of the capabilities of all those various models and packages them together so that we can do these thought experiments on remediation strategy.
Okay, so we're coming up at about 3:10 or 3:11, pardon me, Eastern. I'm going to go ahead and try to squeeze in another question that came in online before we close things up today. And this last question we're going to take online comes from Christine, who asks, can the model simulate matrix diffusion, for example, diffusion of mass from less permeable to more permeable aquifer portions, which occurs in aged plumes?
And this is Chuck. I think the way to think about it is that it can simulate it in the source term. And if you think you have that's an important process for you, you would then put a gamma that's greater than 1, perhaps a gamma of 2, and then you get this long tail of concentration coming out of the source zone. In the plume, it can't do it. It just doesn't see the clays and silts out there, and it won't have any matrix diffusion. So in the plume, as the plume is expanding, those concentrations will be over-predicted, but as the plume recedes, the concentrations will be too optimistic in the model.
Okay, great. So I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up this portion of the online questions. If you've submitted a question electronically and we haven't answered it live, don't worry. It's still in the queue, and I'll be able to pass that question on to our presenters. So before we begin the closeout procedures, I just want to go ahead and check with our presenters to see if anyone has any final statements that they'd like to make.
Well, thanks, everybody, for attending again, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, this is Brian. Go ahead and fire it up. If you have any trouble with just the logistics of it, don't forget it's reading and writing lots of files, so you have to run an administrator and the net framework and all the things that are on the CMOS site when you download it. But we're really excited about this, and we'll do more RemFuel next time and really start digging into combined remedies.
Yeah, this is Chuck. Yeah, looking forward to some of the RemFuel stuff. I think there's a lot of neat discussion on that in terms of figuring how to apply it to sites. You guys don't have any of the high-pressure homework this time, but instead spend your time playing around with a model.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much, gentlemen. So I'm going to go ahead on slide number 65 and start the closeout procedures. This is just a brief reminder for everybody. We are trying to stay connected with our target audiences on the CLUIN website. So if you're interested in interacting with myself or some of our other speakers or are looking for information, suggesting new topics for internet seminars, please feel free to reach out to us. You'll find CLUIN actually has representation on popular social media sites like Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. The other thing we also like to let everybody know is that today's session was recorded. You will automatically get an email as soon as that recording is available for free replay. If you're familiar with our older archives on CLUIN, the recording's going to be a little bit different. It's not just going to be an MP3 or audio file. You're actually going to be able to click a link and watch the whole thing online in a web browser window and actually have interactive pods and windows to download things. If you are looking to either download those files that were used in the demonstration today, you'll find them on the additional resources page, which is hyperlinked on slide number 66. That same resource page is listed in the related URLs pod up in the upper right corner. You'll see something that says homework and files. You can also find the resources page on the seminar homepage. And of course, I'll email everyone a follow-up email after today's seminar with the direct links to get to those files if you'd like to play with them. You can also find the Q&A from part one in that pod on the right side. You also find that type of information on the additional resources for the first seminar, or part one, that was delivered last week. We posted that during today's session. The other resource that you'll find on slide 66 is a link to our short feedback form. We would ask that you take just a minute to go ahead and fill that very short online form out. I do read each and every one of the responses posted there. And again, we're looking for comments and questions and thoughts about the content and the actual topic that you sat in on today, as well as the delivery mechanism. So I would thank you all in advance for taking just a minute to fill that form out. I do know that multiple people may have shared the line, and please note that when you fill that form out, once you've filled it out, there's a link that'll appear that'll allow another person to actually hop on and fill out their own feedback form. So you can each submit your own feedback for the event. Although we don't offer CEUs or PDHs for CLUIN training, you may find that if you have a copy of the presentation materials or slides, again, available in the pods and that resources page, you have a copy of your registration email, and then you fill out your feedback form and check the box to ask for a confirmation email. If you keep that material together, you may find that the accrediting organization requiring the training may actually give you credit for CLUIN sessions. So be careful when you're filling out the feedback form to make sure your email address is entered correctly. And again, each person can fill out their own form and get their own confirmation message. Note those links are going to be active from this point forward. So if you need to come back and fill the form out tomorrow or another day next week, you're certainly welcome to do so. And if you're one of the lucky ones replaying this broadcast after the live delivery, that feedback form is still live, and you can certainly go ahead and fill that out. Again, I want to thank the over 430 individuals who wound up joining us from all over the country. I hope that you found that not only did our content work for you, but the delivery mechanism was